When I asked her about a salary, she said most years there isn't one. And she was the person who told me, no, you know, I sort of alternate between moments of prosperity and putting everything on credit cards.
Hi, I'm Andrew Goldstein, and this is The Art Angle, a podcast from ArtNet News where the art world meets the real world, bringing each week's biggest story down to earth. All right, so we've all seen the movie with the glamorous art dealer, maybe a villain, who lives in a cutting-edge palatial home, drives an impressive car, speaks with an impressive accent. That pretty much is the image of the art dealer in the popular consciousness, a sophisticated, suave, sexy, probably ruthless, strikingly dressed person who is conspicuously rich. But how well does this image match up with reality? Recently, ArtNet News senior market reporter Eileen Kinsella teamed up with the ace investigative art journalist Zachary Small to find out just how much art dealers actually do make from their jobs. And what they found is pretty surprising. In fact, it's extremely surprising. It might even be shocking. Their full report, which is available on ArtNet News Pro, is now officially required reading for the art industry. Personally, I might be as interested in how they managed to get this information as what they've learned. So to find out the story and the story behind the story, I'm pleased to have Eileen and Zachary on the show today. Thanks very much for coming on The Art Angle, guys. You've both been here before, but never as the powerhouse duo that you so evidently are. What was it like working together on this?
It was great. I felt like right at the start, I was sort of just listening to Zachary talk about how the survey should be structured, what kind of questions to ask. It was really interesting to see how you pose the questions to get what you want. I'm used to doing that in regular verbal interviews, but this was a different level of information gathering. Zachary, maybe you want to speak about that.
Although I'm in the art world, I do consider myself a little bit of a data nerd. So it was nice to sort of return to thinking about these numbers and how to form this survey and to work with Eileen to really report out what we were finding and seeing if people had stories behind those numbers, I think was so important to make these things jump from the page.
So to step back for a second, why is this survey important? Why does it matter how much art dealers make, and why do this survey now?
To answer that question of why now, you have to look at the last maybe 3 years in the art world where there's been a growing consensus, at least in the museum field, that salary transparency was needed to provide some sort of clarity on how much people were earning for the massive amounts of education that goes into actually entering this profession. And what that found in the museum field around 2019 was that, you know, a lot of museum workers were making very, very low wages. And what that led to was a larger discussion about privilege and elitism in these institutions and how you could really only afford to work at a museum if you came from a wealthy background. These are things that were already expected as they were expected in the commercial gallery world, but had not really been meted out with actual data to support it. So that's what we wanted to do, provide some salary transparency, at least some base measurement to understand what it was like to be a commercial gallerist, how much money you could expect to make, and what that would actually mean for your livelihood.
So usually people are very reluctant to talk about their salaries. It just makes people squeamish. How did you structure your methodology in getting this information? And how did you go about conducting the survey itself? And how did you split up the work?
In terms of creating the survey, there's always a balance in any sort of sample of asking questions where you get specific and asking questions where you're more general, but will probably have a higher likelihood of getting more responses. So we tried to find sort of a happy medium in there. Some of our questions were open-ended where we wanted more details, but other ones were asking respondents to check boxes for things such as, do you get paid vacation? Do you get family leave or maternity leave? Those kinds of questions, I think, were really important to really round out the data. It's also, you know, realizing that salaries are not the only way that people get paid, especially in the art world or the fashion world. There's other things that go into that. And so we wanted to be able to get these base measurements while also still understanding the larger economic picture of the art world.
If I could add to that, Zach, I was looking back at some of the brainstorming that went on with the questions and how they were structured. And I thought it was very interesting how in some cases it made more sense to offer a wider variety of options or even just then as the job title, because things are so varied that there was a list of possible roles that people could have, and then another box that said other, because obviously many, many different descriptions go into different people's roles at various galleries. And that just got me thinking about what kind of information we were seeking to get and then how to interpret that. So that part of the process was also really helpful.
If I am correct here, I think that Zachary, you focused on the data side of the equation, and Eileen focused on a little bit more of the reporting. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's accurate.
So how many people did you reach out to in total?
In terms of survey responses, we got over 300 responses. And then between Eileen and me, on the reporting side, we probably spoke to around a dozen or so people.
And how many people didn't respond?
Well, the survey was on an invitational basis. It showed up, and if you wanted to take it, you could. It was purely voluntary.
Yeah, it was all voluntary.
Okay, so here we kind of set the table in terms of the methodology a little bit. And I'm curious, before we dive into it, what did you expect to find? Did you have any kind of preconceptions of what you were going to uncover?
I did. I say that, and I think that's part of my fascination with the responses that we got, because for all the years that I've been in the art world, a lot of the stories that I've heard about executive levels and some bad behavior and treatment of lowly gallerinas and desk assistants, a lot of that was not only borne out, but borne out very specifically. And the fact that people didn't necessarily have to provide their name unless they chose to, and some people did, and we could follow up with them, made it even that much more detailed and fascinating as to see what goes on in terms of what we found with this huge gap in pay between executive level and lower level.
Spoiler alert, there's a huge gap. What did you actually find out? What did the data reveal?
So in terms of the data, what we found was that when just isolating for people that identified as gallery directors, most of those people were making more than $100,000, with a few top earners reaching towards the millions. So that's quite the range, but obviously, depending on how successful the operation is, there is room for a lot of success. By comparison, when looking at gallery assistants, those employees really hit a wage ceiling of about $35,000, which is not exactly what you want to be earning. Maybe for entry level, for like the first year, that might be okay, but gallery assistants is kind of a misnomer. A lot of people that are assistants work in that job for years and years and years. And $35,000 is about 30% lower than what MIT would define as the living wage in New York State, for instance.
You know, to set the brackets here, what was the highest salary that you encountered and what was the lowest salary?
Well, the lowest salary was $0. That's with the caveat, of course, people also reported earning money through sales commission or year-end bonuses. So, you know, these are people that weren't getting an official salary, but were maybe scraping things off at the year's end. On the higher end of things, people would estimate above $700,000. So definitely reaching towards the millions. And I think it's safe to assume some of the people that didn't respond to our survey that are working at the mega galleries are easily clearing the $1 million mark.
You had some very interesting findings when you broke things down by the median salary and then also the mode salary. So can you explain what those mean and what the numbers were?
Yeah, so in case anyone wants to revisit their SAT, ACT days, the mean salary is the average of all these numbers together, and the median is the middle number of all the salaries. So looking at these responses, for example, just dealers, you know, executives, owners, the median salary for an owner, director, or partner was about $65,000, while the mode, which is the most repeating number, was really much lower at about $10,000. What that indicates to us is a volatility in the market, where it's not like you could go into the art world and expect, oh, if I run my own gallery and really work on things, I can make X amount of dollars. It really is a Russian roulette.
So you kind of can expect that if you're starting your own business, it has certain inherent risks. You're going to be investing in this business for a while. Maybe you're not going to be making money in hopes of better returns. That's understandable. But you were talking about gallery assistants, and gallery assistants are obviously hired into existing galleries by dealers who have established them and are successful enough to hire people out. And you mentioned that salaries typically cap out at $35,000, or as you mentioned, 30% below a living wage in New York. I think it's another way of looking at that, as you point out, is that That means it's $17 an hour if you calculate a 40-hour work week. And that means that it's just $16 more per day than the lowest ranking worker at an Amazon warehouse makes, because they just got a $15 minimum wage instituted in 2018. So that's crazy, because the job requirements of an Amazon warehouse worker are pretty much to be 18 years old, to be able to read and speak English, and to have a high school level education. So on the flip side, what are the job requirements for being a gallery assistant?
You know, I would describe being a gallery assistant as not just being in a white collar job, but being in a white glove job. Oftentimes these are people at this point in the art market with masters in art history or some adjacent discipline, and people that have gone to school for years and years and years to be able to do this. So when you look at how much someone might be paying in student loans, you know, for a grad school program for 2 years, that could be around $160,000. To be making $35,000 a year, that's probably just not going to cut it. I know just sort of qualitatively from talking to gallery assistants that a lot of these people have second or third jobs.
And Andrew, I think it's so interesting that you make that comparison between Amazon, because whenever in our world have we heard somebody compare working in a gallery to being an Amazon worker? Sarah Merkett, who was one of the great recruiters that I spoke with, pulled it out when she said the art market is a luxury business and it's an incredibly privileged one. These numbers are the furthest thing from that for a younger person or a person at a lower level that you could get.
What's amazing is that these aren't necessarily easy jobs to get. These are pretty competitive
exactly.
jobs. So how can you explain why people take these jobs if the pay is so low?
Because of everything that's associated with the allure of the art world and the supposed glamour, it's probably the exact same thing that you start off with saying, the stereotypical character that's portrayed in a movie living in a penthouse with all these different cars and living among masterpieces. What this survey shows and what conversations with people show is that there's a very, very different side to that, especially for younger people who are starting out, no matter how much education and how much privilege they have. I mean, if they come from wealthy families, which has often been the norm, that's maybe a little bit of a cushion, but it doesn't mean that their salary is going to be any higher.
And I would say, too, at this point in 2021, I think it is getting harder for galleries as well as museums to recruit young people into these jobs. Gen Z is much more aware of these salary disparities and sort of the overpromising, not only of places like the art world, but I think of corporations in general for this sort of like, you know, lifestyle at the expense of a larger salary deal. We found this in previous reporting during the COVID pandemic, where a lot of young people were actually deciding to permanently exit the art industry because of how hard it is to work there.
I mean, you're speaking of the COVID pandemic, that obviously had a real epical shock to the world economy. And I wonder, are your findings reflecting that? Or are your findings reflecting something more systemic and baked into the system?
It seems like once again, the split applies, where a lot of dealers that we spoke to over the past year actually did quite well. We had a number of reports showing how people were just spending a lot more time at home. They had a lot of excess cash. The stock market did really well. So a lot of people were putting their money into art. They also want to look at something beautiful or interesting on their wall when they're spending so much time inside. But then we also have some data in the survey about the number of people that were furloughed or took pay cuts. And once again, that's the lower end of the hierarchy.
About a fifth of our respondents had pay cuts during the COVID-19 pandemic. And if you really dive into the data and get into regions that are outside mega art hubs like New York or London, you do start seeing a bit of a slump in salaries, at least a difference, which sure, some of that is about the cost of living, where collectors are, but I think it is also indicative of those challenges that more regional art galleries have faced during the pandemic with the loss of tourism, for instance.
So when it comes to making a quote unquote living wage, what does that even mean? Because we know that sometimes the people who take these jobs are people who don't really need to work for a living. They have family money, they're fairly soigné. So how were you able to determine how many people who have these jobs basically don't really need to be earning a salary?
Well, I think that question's kind of outside of the data set, really. It's an issue that the industry has been grappling with for, if not the last year, then the last decade of making promises about diversity, which goes beyond just race, but also is frankly about class. These are issues that places like Pace Gallery, David's Werner have been trying to address and have been trying to do that actually very publicly. But for instance, when you look into the data that we have and you ask, well, how many of these gallerists identified as white, for instance, out of the 288 responses that we got who identified their race, 85% of those people were white. When you took that to the executive level, 93% identified as white. So, you know, these questions of, I think, privilege, who needs the salary, should they get the salary, those questions are tied up and bound in the questions of diversity and how galleries are trying to grapple with both the idea that they've blown up into these blue chip markets over the last 20 years, but also that they have a commitment to an increasingly diverse roster of artists that needs to be reflected within their own diversity of staff.
And another thing that I thought was so interesting, Andrew, that I feel like bears a little bit of highlighting is coincidentally, some of these owner founders that we spoke to, at least three, who basically told us that they don't take any salary beyond what they need to meet their rent costs or pay some bills. They either rely on a spouse or a partner who might have an income, or that, as one of our respondents told us, that she just piles everything on a credit card when she needs to. She tries to pay bills when she can, and that her business sort of alternates between moments of prosperity and moments of more credit card debt. And that's probably the most, I'd say, in the middle between, you know, if we're talking about this huge gap of people making close to a million or upwards of a million, and then people barely at the poverty line, then you have these people also really working their tails off, but just hoping to sort of keep it going and take it to the next level. That was a very interesting subset, I thought.
At the risk of being overly generalizing, this is changed for the better in some visible respects, but for a long time, it used to be the fact that if you wanted to name a Black art dealer, you would be pretty stumped. There were so few Black art dealers, and especially Black dealers who had their names on the door, that it was kind of incomprehensible. And then, as you said, Zachary, now there has been a huge wellspring of movement towards inclusion in the gallery roster and also within the gallery itself in terms of the staff. So I wonder how much of the fact that there hasn't been so much inclusion in the past is based on some kind of, you know, ingrained racism in the art world, and how much of it is based on these low entry-level salaries?
I think these are issues that if you were to ask gallery assistants who've gone through either diversity issues or have experienced racism in one of these big galleries, and we've certainly spoken to many people who have had that experience, they would say that the issues of money and of race are sort of bound together in the gallery system, where privilege exists on multiple different levels. I mean, a place like Pace Gallery is ultimately a family-run business. You at this point have three generations of Glimshers running different parts, although Lilith Glimsher just was in Pace to help set up a diversity thing. And now she sort of left that role to let other people lead it. But sometimes you do need that push from a younger generation to get things going. And people that have come in, they're committed, and I think increasingly more outspoken about what it's like to be, for instance, a Black person working in a white cube. People that we speak to have had a really difficult time, by and large, doing that. And so when you see gallerists that are trying to champion artists of color and trying to champion gallerists of color, I think it's helpful to just know that that takes an immense amount of courage, an immense amount of support.
And further to what Zachary mentioned about the high number of people that responded to the survey who identified their race, who said that they are white, identify as white, you know, we weren't even really able to have enough data to dive into in that respect to get what the gap might be between white and then people of color. We were at least able to say, and this is something that was pulled out, a difference in the wage gap between men and women, where the average salary for executives who identified as female was just shy of 80,000, and white men reported pay that was 30% higher at 110,000. We were not really able to gather enough information to even sufficiently analyze and say that there's a disparity in salaries between white and non-white dealers or workers.
So Eileen, you spoke to a wide array of dealers in reporting this story. Mm-hmm. Were there any dealers, anonymous or not, whose stories really resonated with you or taught you something that you didn't know already?
One of the people I really enjoyed speaking to was Allegra Laviola, who's the owner, founder of Sargent's Daughters on the Lower East Side. And that's a gallery that I think just consistently mounts great shows. Pretty much any time that I look at what her show is, I like it or I become interested in it. And she was one of the people who told me, when I asked her about a salary, she said most years there isn't one. And she was the person who told me, no, you know, I sort of alternate between moments of prosperity and putting everything on credit cards. And she did say that she's done okay during the pandemic, but the notion of a budget and hiring somebody has been sort of a distant dream for her for a long time. She's now getting around to bringing on her first full-time employee, and she's had other people help, like assistants and handlers. To me, she's a well-established and very well-regarded person. So for her to tell me that she didn't take a salary and was relying on a partner who had an income to, you know, make ends meet was pretty surprising. And again, that story was repeated in quite a few of the people that we spoke to, of reinvesting all the proceeds or just taking enough to make their rent and just wanting to grow the gallery. And, you know, in some cases being successful, but definitely under a lot of stress.
I mean, what it sounds like you're describing is a nonprofit. This is obviously a commercial gallery, but what you're describing sounds a lot more like a nonprofit. How do you explain that kind of disconnect?
The way that I look at it now is to say, well, what does it say that everybody or most of the people who are making $100,000 and above are well-established directors at mega galleries? It almost is sort of like, hey, if you want to make that kind of money, maybe go work for one of the big megas, because clearly it's a different story as a lower level or a mid-level. You're basically like a sole proprietor type. One would imagine it would be more profitable. Who knows? Maybe it will be down the road. But clearly, you know, we did meet a certain group of people that were all in this same boat. And as you say, kind of effectively functioning as a nonprofit.
So Zachary, same question for you. Were there any dealers you spoke to whose personal stories seem to be especially telling?
Yeah, one of the persons that I spoke to is Max Marshall, who runs a gallery that's going to be opening this summer in Tribeca called Deli Gallery. He's basically taken this over the last about 5 years, taken it from a tiny space on like the second floor of a building in Queens to Brooklyn and now into Tribeca. And what interested me, you know, thinking about the story that Eileen just shared about Sargent's Daughters, is that Deli Gallery has kind of focused more on a traditional model of really working with young, interesting artists that are more so at the beginning of their careers and really trying to have a dealer who presents the work, really tries to have a network of other dealers, have a network of collectors and build that. And, you know, Max himself is someone that sort of worked his way through the blue chip gallery system, working at Pace Gallery under Douglas Baxter, who now has kind of an infamous reputation, and working at Matthew Marks, which similarly has a reputation for a really intense environment. You know, the generation of younger dealers like Max, who's in his early 30s, is about trying to undo some of that intensity that has pushed a lot of people out of the art industry at this point and has made a lot of artists uncomfortable, and at least for the time being, in this sort of startup environment that these young gallerists are in. They're talking about, you know, making it more equitable, making it more friendly, and bringing the people they work with into the fold, you know, trying to share profits in the end.
Also, we spoke with David DeBoer, who's a gallerist in East Los Angeles, and he was one of the ones that told me, you know, he didn't take a salary, yet over the past year, things have been healthy and robust enough that he was able to triple the size of his gallery in East Los Angeles. That's an encouraging thing to hear. And then he also told me that the one employee that he does have, who's a sales director, he made him an equity partner because his hope is to want to encourage this person to share in the success of the gallery as it grows. Now, clearly, those people are rare among the people that we spoke to, but perhaps that's something, at least a step in a new direction, where if we're talking about younger people not willing to put up with such low wages or these conditions, maybe it's a sign of things at least starting to turn, or at least an acknowledgement of better treatment is needed.
So there's one thing that everybody knows about the art business, even if they have no interest in it whatsoever, and that's that art is very expensive. People often view valuable art and use valuable art as a kind of a financial asset, which makes you think that maybe the art business is kind of like the finance industry or something like that. But that's not true at all. I mean, it actually seems like it's more like the restaurant industry, where businesses fail, it's hard to make a lot of money, and most people earn these really menial wages. What do you think is a better comparison for the art business?
I think it's some weird Frankenstein of the fashion industry meets restaurants, meets finance at this point. And it's a product of a market that has been going up and up for the last 20 years. We saw it, you know, just a couple of weeks ago in the auctions, that after a global pandemic where a lot of people lost a lot of income and the rich actually made a lot of money, you know, you had more than $1 billion of sales in 1 week. So I think when you're looking at this, you know, you can look at the assistants and say, hey, these are people that are getting treated like waiters in many ways, only without the tips. You can look at the fashion industry and probably say the same thing, because nobody in the fashion industry makes money, really. What makes the art industry so interesting for a lot of people on the business side is that there's just so many weird factors to it. The artists are their own weird factor that you can't really analyze in any scientific way, but it's also an industry of big whales, right? That can come in, if they're a devoted collector, change the entire lifespan of a gallery.
So as you mentioned, Zachary, you know, the art world has been facing these numerous reckonings in recent years over various kinds of embedded inequalities. And we just saw the Whitney Museum became the latest major museum to have its staff unionize, and that happened amid this major nationwide unionization drive at museums all over the place. And Zachary, you've been reporting extensively on instances of harassment, discrimination, lack of representation in both museums and galleries. But, you know, these dealer salaries just doesn't seem to have been something that has ever come up for, you know, scrutiny or agitation. Why do you think that is?
If you look at the museum world, these things have come up, of course. The whole salary transparency movement is what birthed the unionization movement. And the Whitney's decision to voluntarily recognize the union, I think, is the result of just so many bitter, bitter battles in major museums across the country and leadership wanting to avoid that. But when you look at galleries, you haven't seen any unionization happen yet. I think that's probably why discussions of salary haven't really bubbled up to the surface in the same way that, you know, a museum worker at this point would, many of them would willingly just go on the record and tell you about it. People feel like sometimes with these unionization drives, there's power in numbers to discuss.
Yeah, where it's definitely so much more fragmented at galleries and so much more varied. And perhaps it's notable that, you know, when we went to the ADAA and New Art Dealers Association, we didn't really get much of a response back from them about to what extent they've ever tried to track gallery worker survey or if that is a concern to them.
Yeah, just going off of that too, I would say it would be a misunderstanding for gallerists to think that these are not issues because people aren't talking about it. I think what we found in our reporting and in the survey is that salaries are, of course, at the top of people's minds. And the fact that they, you know, assistants aren't getting paid a lot of money really impacts how they see themselves long-term in this industry. You know, we got a lot of comments, some of them anonymous, from gallery assistants, just talking about how they felt mistreated, how they felt like they dealt with tons of racism for starving wages, and it just wasn't worth it. That's going to come out eventually in sort of the challenges that galleries have to deal with.
So somebody might come from the outside and look at this picture that you're painting and say, wow, this survey shows an industry that is working, that has figured out a way to use non-monetary incentives to keep fixed costs low and lift profits. What would you tell somebody, you know, some business school savant who thinks that this is the sign of a highly functioning, efficient marketplace?
You know, I have this one source that teaches at a business management school, and I always ask him this question. And he always comes back to the long-term view of things. If I look at my email, I can pull up, you know, one out of every two emails is from someone telling me about a gallery or a museum or, you know, an issue that they're having. It's not a great long-term strategy for an industry to be constantly bashed by its employees. I don't think that that necessarily helps gallerists, not at the top of the industry and not at the bottom. I think it also puts artists in a really difficult position. Right now, we haven't seen many blue chip artists who are willing to go on the record and badmouth their dealers, but you know that can change. Artists are a fickle bunch. Increasingly, artists see their market tied to social justice movements and their participation in those conversations. So I think that by continuing on the path that they're going, you know, this is found in sort of the coverage of the art world now, it's going to put gallerists in a really difficult place if the industry and the economics don't change.
Last question. You're both, you know, really experienced art journalists. You've talked to tons of people in all aspects of the field over time. What really, really surprised you?
I would probably look at the case of Ruhl Gallery. I talked to the director there, Valerie, and what she told me is Ruhl Gallery is based in Denver and Marfa. It has two locations. And yet what I was so surprised about is that it only has a few employees. She said it's like 2 to 3 employees, depending on the season. And that kind of blew my mind that this woman is working more than 60 hours per week, managing two locations on opposite ends of the country. I'm still kind of in awe of that. I don't know how so many of the gallerists that answered our survey are running these operations, you know, having to package things, ship things, install things, exhibit, doing all the literature and email involved. I have no idea how they're doing all of that at the same time.
Yeah, I would second that in terms of the number of, you know, mid-level or smaller gallery owners that said their hourly working could be anywhere between 40 and 80, depending on the week. And also just how much the nature of running their own gallery was just an ongoing thing that might involve calls or deals or whatever at any hour of the day or night. That was a little bit surprising to me too, like that number of like 60 to 80 hours per week for somebody who, again, might not necessarily be collecting a salary.
Okay. Well, you know, guys, congratulations on a really extraordinary piece of journalism. You know, we split the story into two pieces where there's more of a general overview of what you found in the study, and that's on ArtNet News. And then there's a really nitty-gritty kind of deep dive into the actual salaries and the different pay structures that is behind ArtNet News Pro. And I think this is a perfect example of a story that really shows the value of what you get from ArtNet News Pro, because it's journalism that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Anyway, with that little plug delivered, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having us, Andrew.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of The Art Angle. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Also, make sure to check out Shattering the Glass Ceiling, our exciting podcast mini-series focusing on inspiring women in the art world. The Art Angle is produced by Sonia Manalili, Tim Schneider, and Caroline Goldstein. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.